inside the pair coming in at Daventry, rolled over itself in midair, and elongated as it did, coming out of the spin as another dark elf. "Vampires," he heard Vestra say. He turned to look at her, but she wasn't looking back. Torch in hand, she fled for the exit. "I go!" the dwarf called, turning to Daventry to see the man already engaged with two of the undead. Surprisingly swift, they dodged his wild attacks, and when one managed to get in behind an attack and swing its arm against the man's shoulder, Daventry was lifted from the ground and thrown to the side by the sheer force of the blow. Brunner growled and started to charge to the big man's aid, but he skidded to a stop and called out a warning to Vestra as more large wings filled the air around her. She thrashed with her torch, first at bats, then at vampires, and the torch went flying to the floor as a trio of forms fell over the screaming elf woman, bearing her down. Brunner didn't know where to turn. He swung back for Daventry, but found the man flailing, a drow creature upon his back, biting him around the neck and head. Daventry swung around and thrashed and kicked, and managed to get his sword up and over his shoulder, driving it deeply into the creature, which fell away with an otherworldly shriek, but taking Daventry's sword with it. The man started after, desperate to retrieve his weapon, but he had only gone a step before two more of the creatures tackled him, clawing and biting ravenously. Brunner didn't see that last part, for now he found another pair of undead dark elves coming in at him, reaching for him with cold, clawing hands. His axe hit one squarely and turned it aside, but he could not win. He knew that, particularly from the screams of Vestra, who was shortly in the last moments of her life. Brunner ran for the throne, calling to Moradin, demanding the strength he had known before. He couldn't win, and he couldn't escape. Two pursued him, nipping at his heels. If he leaped upon the throne and was rejected, he would be killed before he ever regained his footing. He knew that. So he veered, around the throne, toward the two graves, though he knew not why. The pursuit was too close. He stopped and turned, launching a heavy slash that caught the nearest creature in the side and buried the axe head halfway through it, sending it flying away. Brunner barely held on to the weapon and found himself turned and off balance as the second vampire closed in hungrily. He caught himself, planted his foot, and pivoted back fast the other way, hardly thinking of the motion as he let fly the battle axe, spinning it end over end. It hit the charging drow square in the chest with tremendous force and drove it backward into the darkness. Brunner didn't pursue, instead turning for the graves, for the unopened cairn. His grave, he hoped, and prayed too that his weapon would be in there. He slid down to the floor, grabbing the nearest cairnstone and rolling it aside. Vestra had gone silent by then, and Brunner tried to block out the frantic calls of Daventry, tried to focus on his desperate, seemingly hopeless task. "They're eating me!" the man screamed, and Brunner swallowed hard and tossed another stone aside. He heard scuffling behind him as he reached for the third rock, and instead of just pushing it off the cairn, he hoisted it, turned, and heaved it into the face of the charging vampire, knocking it aside. Brunner spun and dropped to his knees, and understood that it was indeed his grave, for he saw a portion of the skeleton within then, its bone hands wrapped around the handle of a weapon he surely recognized. He dived for it, reaching desperately, confident that if he had that many-notched axe in hand once more, he would fight his way through this, leaving severed pieces of drow vampires in his wake. He almost had it. A heavy boot slammed down on his forearm, crushing his arm against the rocks, stopping his progress cold. And the vampires gathered around him, on all sides now, reaching for him, red eyes leering, white fangs shining, even in the dim light. Chapter 23. The Grinning Halfling Hero. The Year of the Grinning Halfling, 1481 DR. Eltergard. The wagon bounced along the tradeway, more than 100 miles northwest of the town of Triel, and 5 times that distance still from Waterdeep. Regis sat in the back, huddled under a heavy winter blanket, for the season grew late. His legs dangled off the tailgate, peeking out from under his cover and showing fabulous high black boots that had miraculously escaped the dirt of the road thus far.
"Smoke in the west!"
came the expected call from one of the riders flanking the merchant caravan, and the halfling nodded at the confirmation of their location. Regis had been this way before, though many decades had passed since then. By his estimate, they were approaching the river called Winding Water and the famous span known as the Borskier Bridge. The sun lowered before them, and looking back beyond the forest of worms and the reaching woods, Regis noted the aptly named glistening peaks of the Sunset Mountains far in the distance. The halfling nodded again, taking measure of the journey that had begun on a dark, late summer's night in Delfuntal. On the far side of those mountains in the distance, their eastern foothills reached down to the westernmost banks of the Sea of Fallen Stars, the great sea that had been in his sight for every day of his second life until this very journey. He had sailed from Delfuntal to Procamper in the kingdom of Impeltor on the northern banks of the sea, and from there to the city of Suzail, seat of power for the great kingdom of Cormyr. Regis could only sigh now as he thought of that grand and bustling place, with its fine markets and the stirring parades of the armies of purple dragons. Thousands of people called Suzail home. Truly, Suzail stood among the greatest of Faerun cities. And the palaces! Ah, but Regis could only smile and nod and pat his belt pouch, wherein rested his housebreaker harness, as he thought of those gilded mansions. He had seen the interior of many of them, though usually in the dark of night and without use of a torch. He nodded more confidently, assuring himself that he would return there some day. Indeed, Regis would not have left Suzail so abruptly, except that a particular lord of the city also happened to be an accomplished wizard. If only Regis had known that before paying a visit to the man's house one night. Disguised as the gnome Manfoodle, for indeed his wondrous beret could even make him appear as a different race, a friend from another time and another life, Regis had departed the city by the end of the summer of the Year of the Grinning Halfling, buying passage on a caravan bound 100 miles down the western road to Prosker, and 100 more after that on to the town of Ireabor, the very western edge of the kingdom of Cormyr. And there Nanfoodle had simply disappeared, and so had come into being the dwarf Cordio Muffinhead. Cordio had traveled the length of the kingdom of Eltergard, riding the tradeway to Triel, where again it had been time for a change of identity. And so, with the tip of a blue-speckled beret, Spider Pericolo Topolino, great-nephew of the Pericolo Topolino of Aglarond, had been born. What a year it had been, Regis mused. What a journey, full of sights and sounds and smells and foods any traveler would envy. He had lived as a street orphan, a gnome potion maker, a dwarf adventurer, and now a halfling dilettante, dabbling in artwork, overpaying for all, then, of course, retrieving his spent coins in the